It started with the biggest pipe bomb the FBI had ever seen.
There is a bomb in Centennial Park. You have 30 minutes.
It ended in a dumpster after the largest manhunt in American history.
My knees knocked so hard that I was about to answer them. That's how nervous I was.
Eric Rudolph and the rise of anger.
Domestic terrorism has been metastasizing across the country for a long time now.
True story, true crime, true consequences for us all.
American Shrapnel, from award-winning journalists Becca Andrews and John Archibald, two-time winner of the Pulitzer Prize. Now available wherever you get your podcasts.
There you are, pushing your newborn baby in a stroller through the park. The first time out of the house in weeks. You have your Starbucks, venti, because, you know, sleep deprivation. You meet your best friend. She asks you how it's going. You immediately begin to laugh, then cry, then laugh cry. That's totally normal, right? She smiles. You hug. There's no one else you'd rather share this with. You know, 3.5 hours sleep is more than enough. Starbucks, it's never just coffee.
I can remember talking to Jeremy Pruitt when he was at Alabama. And we were talking about, because we were talking about watching film. And he's like, Cole, these guys ain't like you were. He's like, we went in there, y'all go in there, watch film for 3 hours. And y'all were fine. He's like, these kids go in there now. He goes, I make them watch for 10 minutes and then we get a 2 minute break. 10 minutes and we get a 2 minute break. And I'm sitting there going, God, that would have been amazing.
Hey, welcome to Beat Everyone. I am Ben Flanagan with AL.com. And once again, we are joined by the Auburn football legend, now SEC Network analyst and reporter, co-host of McElroy and Kubelik in the morning on WJOX, frequent AL.com contributor, the great Cole Kubelik. Cole, welcome back. Thank you for doing this. You know we're big fans of yours.
Oh, I appreciate that. I appreciate you guys having me. It's good to be back with you.
So, Cole, I'm curious. This is the off season, right? And I just want to know, as an ESPN analyst, a guy who travels all over the country, watches as much football film sessions as you do, how do you spend an off season? Like, when the national title game is over, do you get a break, or is it just getting started for you as you prepare to cover the next season? Like, is it a nonstop film session? Like, when does the season sort of begin and end for you related to what we perceive as the college football calendar?
I don't know if it really ends, but it definitely begins, because my wife would tell you when I start going out of town, that changes a lot of different things for her, of course. She tells me that I have she calls it a reacclimation period, and she says it's between 2 and 3 weeks. And it just, they know that I'm going to be grumpy and I'm going to be a little ornery, and that I just need some time to get back into the swing of things and understand what real life actually entails, with responsibilities like taking the garbage out, taking kids to school, picking kids up, taking kids to practice, not laying around all day in bed if you actually had the opportunity to do that. So it was funny, because I mentioned that to McElroy on the show the other day, and he's like, he goes, yeah, my wife basically says the same thing. She doesn't call it that. But yeah, there's like this acclimation period of almost a month where you just sort of decompress and figure out, okay, I'm a member of the real world again. I can actually do things. But then I have UFL in a month, so I kind of prepare for that a little bit. I do like to go back and catch up on things, whether it was Oregon or whether it was a team like Mississippi State that I didn't have a bunch during the year, and I just kind of want to catch up. I'll start looking at guys for the draft so I can get a better thought on them. I actually, once the season's over, it's usually 2, sometimes 3 weekends of NFL, and I have access to NFL film on my laptop, and I'll try to dive into the teams in the playoffs, because I've missed so much of it. I just want to have a little bit of an idea of what they look like and how they operate, because I watch minimal NFL during the season. I would love to watch all of it. I just can't. I literally can't watch it. And so I try to go back, catch up on a little bit of that. But man, it gets right back into it. It's baseball practice. It's tumbling. It's school. It's pickup. We had coding night at my daughter's school the other night. I didn't know what coding was. I'm not just still not sure I know what it is. She was shocked that I had never coded. She's 9.
And what is coding? What is it?
I think it's some sort of creating an algorithm for websites or companies. It didn't solve a lot of the questions that I had, but we did it together and it was cool. And we won a robot, which she was really excited about. But she was really surprised that I had never coded. And I said, honey, where would daddy have coded before? And she's like, school. was like, let me tell you about floppy disks. we didn't do that. So
the A drive.
It never slows down, Ben, ever.
No, I understand. Well, let's help you decompress a little bit more. I mean, one more before we get into the Alabama football of it all. Cole, you're a guy who's not afraid to eat on camera. And here's another really tough one for you. What was the best thing that you ate during the season in 2024?
If we're referencing in game or just in general?
In general, like in a college football town on camera, like what was the most memorable meal or item?
Probably Tony's Steakhouse in Lexington. They have this like mashed sweet potatoes that have this giant marshmallow on top of it that's melted into it. The steaks are phenomenal. The apps are phenomenal. If I can get to – when I go to Lexington, I do everything I can to get to Tony's. Thankfully, they usually get us in. But, yeah, a steak dinner at Tony's would probably be at the top of the list.
Gotcha. Okay. Shout out, Tony's.
And I didn't go to Auburn this year, so – I think my guys know where that one would have been if I would have been to Auburn. It would have been Acre, no doubt, but I didn't make it to Auburn this year for a game. Didn't actually have Auburn for a game this year at all.
Wow. Is that a first in your career so far?
Actually, no, it's not the first time. There's usually two, sometimes three teams that we'll randomly not get during the season. And it's just happenstance. I don't think it's anything other than the way that the calendar and the schedule falls. But yeah, it was odd not to get them. I've had them before, but not at home. And this is the second time, I believe, that I haven't had them at all. But it's happened to most SECs. I know Georgia, I haven't had 1 year. Bama, I didn't have 1 year. I know Florida, we didn't have them 1 year. So it happens randomly.
No Auburn this year. Hate that for you, Cole. Well, let's get into Alabama football. I mean, there's big news in Tuscaloosa. There was a couple of days ago. Kalen DeBoer has his guy, right? Ryan Grubb is going to be the offensive coordinator in year two. And this move has been widely celebrated as one of the best of any program during this offseason. Do you see it that way?
Oh, yeah. I think it's an awesome hire. I felt like sort of the triangle of hope, I guess, would have been Kalen with Grubb and also with Scott Huff, the offensive line coach that went with Grubb to the Seahawks. I just think those three have been together so long and know each other so well and have such continuity that when they're all putting things together, it makes it really different. Where Ryan Grubb separates himself is he's a former offensive line coach. And I know people would say, well, you're a lineman. You just like him because of that. I think he really does see the game differently. People often tell me, I'll talk to McElroy or when I do the show on Monday nights with Roman Harper, how'd you see that? Why are you watching there? What? And I say the same things to them sometimes, but I watch the line of scrimmage. And I just think different people have different vantage points of how things are operating. And his pretty much starts there. Also, I've been in a meeting with them where Kalen came back in and we were talking to Grubb and I kind of asked him about something that Grubb said that he didn't want to do and he laughed about it and they started going back and forth about how they can very easily and in a friendly manner challenge one another as to we need to be doing more of this or we need to get away from that and we need to do this. And when you take two brilliant offensive minds like that and you can sort of allow them to form opinions together, that's when I think your offense becomes special. And so to be able to bring him back in the mix that way, I think it's going to be really valuable for Alabama, for the offense, for really just the team in general. And he's a great guy. He's a great guy to have in the facility. He's somebody who I think the players love. He does have sort of that gruff demeanor and attitude, but that's not really his entire personality. I mean, he's a guy you really enjoy sitting down and talking to, and he knows football. So I think it's an awesome gift for Kalen. Anytime you can bring somebody in that you just completely trust, that you know is not trying to one-up you, that's not trying to go get another job, not using it for a stepping stone. And when they come to you and say, hey, coach, this is not the way we need to be doing this, or why are we not doing this? It's not because it's an ego thing or they just feel like that's better for themselves personally or their position group. And it's better for the entire team. And I think that those two will have that.
Yeah, and I mean, it's obviously what he wanted when he came to Tuscaloosa. Ryan Grubb was going to be part of the staff before he went to Seattle. So it seems like this is great news for Kalen DeBoer above all, right? I mean, heading into the 2024 season, a few months removed from it happening, you said that you thought Alabama nailed the hire with Kalen DeBoer. So after his first season, and maybe with some growing pains that we see with any transition, installing the system, navigating the transfer portal, where do you stand now after year one with Kalen DeBoer? Like, do you like what you see right now?
I mean, obviously there's going to be growing pains, I think, with really any transition. And when you transition from the greatest college football coach all time, who also in his era may have been the most demanding college football coach of all time, there's going to be this gigantic sigh of relief from a lot of people involved that all of a sudden feel like they can freelance a little bit. And they're not under, I'm exaggerating here, but they're not under this dictatorship of this guy that is just built so different, and they have to do it his way, and just mentally and emotionally they can't keep up. And all of a sudden you feel that bit of freedom and you think, well, I'll do it my way now. And it's a little bit more lax, and it's not the way that it should be. And so that's just human nature. And I think some of that was inherent. I think some of that was with the players, maybe some people, not all, not even most or a lot of the people in that facility. It's just going to happen that way. Do I like the way that they call plays? Did I like the design of some things? Absolutely. I mean, I could sit there and go back and show you why a lot of the stuff that didn't work could have or should have worked. And I don't really believe in could haves and should haves in football. But the design of a lot of things, I don't really think was why sometimes it failed to a certain extent. Now, this is going to take some, it's going to take some mental adjusting here, Ben, because we're in a different era of college football. Like, I'll put it to you this way. Who won the SEC this year?
Georgia.
You know how many wins they finished with?
10 or 11?
10.
Okay.
How many did Alabama finish with?
9.
Yeah. And it's a failure of a season, right?
That's right. That's right.
I mean, there's going to be more games. There's going to be more kids going different places. There's going to be more talent that's dispersed across more teams throughout college football. Different teams are finding different advantages. They just passed some new legislation to get in the state of Georgia for kids to be able to receive NIL in different ways. And apparently that's going to benefit Georgia and Georgia Tech's program more so than a lot of other states have at their disposal. Eli Drinkwitz did a great job going to the governor of Missouri and being able to find ways to be able to help his team benefit from NIL in the state of Missouri. So it's, I hate to say it's not a level playing field, because that's not always been applicable to Alabama. In a lot of ways, it's still not, because of the tradition, because of the fan base, because of the support, because of the resources. But that also means that you got to change, and you got to find ways to do it in somewhat of a different way. It's going to help you be successful. All in all, I love what I saw from Kalen this year. I would have, the one thing that I probably did not feel great about was I felt like they could have been a little more ground and pound at different times this year. I think he would sit here and tell you the exact same thing. We saw it at the end of the Wisconsin game. We saw it after the Missouri game. Maybe not on the scoreboard was out of control, but you knew Missouri was out of that game. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, here we come. We're going right at you. You can't stop it. I feel like they could have been that in a lot of games, and they just, for whatever reason, decided not to. And once again, I'm not going to sit here and try to be PFF. I don't know what the quarterback's doing at the line of scrimmage. I don't know what's being changed. I don't know who's saying what in the headset. I don't know how all that's operating. Maybe certain run plays were called, changed to pass plays. Maybe some were RPOs and they were thrown and shouldn't have been. I don't know how it all works. But that's one thing where it felt like to me, some call it and run it, essentially, where you call the play and you run the play no matter what the look is. With what they had up front, what they had in the backfield, specifically what they had at tight end to be able to help with that, they could have lived that way a little bit more often.
They had the running backs, right? And one obviously transferred, Justice Haynes, going to Michigan, maybe get more opportunities to touch the ball after playing with a guy, a quarterback like Jalen Milroe, who's getting a lot of the carries. I mean, it works in games like the LSU game, but you go back to the ones that you mentioned, Missouri, and, you know, even South Florida, when it was a close game until the fourth quarter, and those running backs busted the game wide open for Alabama. So, you know, it's interesting because when it comes to first-year coaches, and even from year one to year two, this debate of what's fair and not fair in terms of expectations is what we hear a lot of. And even after Kalen DeBoer's first season, we heard words like inexcusable, right, to describe losses to Vanderbilt, Oklahoma, Michigan, that it was playoff or bust for DeBoer, even in his first year. And that, you know, tell me if I'm wrong, Cole, but like, you don't seem like a guy who like looks at the college football world or competitive world that way, right? It's much more granular. Context obviously really matters, especially with as much film as you watch. But do you see it that way, or does a first year for a coach excuse everything to some degree?
Yeah, no, I understand that there is this Bama standard and
or college football standard. That's at this point, and maybe that's an influence from Bama, especially from Saban, where you want instant success when you bring a guy in. You want a culture change, and you want to win championships when you bring a guy in. But, yeah, with Alabama, maybe more specifically, there, the walls start closing in sooner than it does in other places, right?
No, there's no doubt. But also, and I think Coach Saban, this would probably drive him crazy, but I think if he sat back and thought about it, he would understand there's some reality to this. His equity mattered. And because of what he built, and I understand every day was turn the page, and you have to win that day, and you have to dominate that day. And no team was going to lead to what the next team did. And I'm with him on that, and I agree with that. But however, I think if he looked back on it now, he would say that it's very fair to state that the decade plus of what he put into that program assisted in continuing the success. So to say that all of a sudden you're going to remove a lot of that equity and that it should just be the same, in my opinion, is egregious. To ask that is just not real. No matter what, you're hitting the reset button. And whether that's in recruiting, whether that's maintaining a roster, whether that's the expectation of what a player should do every day, how they work out, how they recover, how they attack practice, how they prepare for games and practice. He had a lot of that built in. And he did a great job of recruiting people who knew how to deliver that message for him a lot of times. But also, let's be real, Ben, like we got more looks at that program the last 4 or 5 years under Nick Saban than combined we did maybe the first 8 years that he was there. So a lot of the recruits coming in knew, oh, this, there's a different kind of guy going and doing this. Like Jonathan Allen's not built like a lot of other human beings. Minkah Fitzpatrick's not built like a lot of other human beings. Like those guys are, they are almost cyborg-like in their approach and their demeanor and how they manage things. And so to expect everyone to just be that again, when the leader of the program had kept it that way for so long, it's just false narrative, in my opinion. It's not going to happen. To sit back and say that the expectation should be a championship every year, let's go back to this time a year ago. And I can recall having the conversations in August, like, hey, man, we used to sit here and say 1, 2, 3, 4, 8, 9. Like, there's a good 8, 10 teams that can win a national title this year. I can remember going into last year thinking 3 could. And I'm going to be honest with you, it might be less this year of teams that I just look at and say, you know what, that team can go win a title. I'll put my name on that team saying they're going to get a championship this year. And last year, I think it was Georgia, Ohio State, and Texas. And this year, I don't know if I can put Ohio State in that category. Georgia might be knocking on the door of that category. A team like Clemson might be in that category, but I don't know if I have a handful of teams that I can sit here and tell you, oh yeah, I definitely can see them going to win a national title this year. That's how different everything is. And if you'd asked me about, listen, it's on record. I thought Ohio State was going to get their ass kicked by Tennessee. I said it. Ask John in the background. He'll tell you. Ohio State fans came after me when they won that game. They had a great time with my quotes that SEC Network put out when we found out what the matchups were going to be. But if you watched Ohio State after that Michigan game, and it wasn't just that game, it was leading up to that game, they didn't look like this killer that was walking around in a predatory manner looking down to take down its prey all day long that no one could even manage or do anything with. But they turned into that in that playoff run. So that's another part of what's happening now that's going to be different than it was under Coach Saban. So I just think you look for dominate your day, dominate the best way that you can. And I understand what Alabama fans expect and want and think that it should be. But there's no guarantee that it's always going to be that. And there's also no guarantee that it's ever going to be that again.
Cole, it's always fun when, you know, you get paid to predict what's going to happen in sports, right? Like you never hear the end of it at that point, depending on the fan base. But you're right about Ohio State. I mean, you weren't the only one. A lot of people thought that Ohio State was going to lose that game. They thought Tennessee had momentum. And then that game woke Ohio State up. They didn't stop after that blowout win at home. And it's so interesting what you're saying about, like, so few teams have a real shot at winning, even with the newly adopted 12-team format.
Well, the reality of that will be that a lot of them have a shot. But I think my point is that which ones would you say right now, oh, I'll bet my mortgage on that one to definitely go do it. And that's what's different than 3 years ago, 5 years ago, 8 years ago, is that even during the Bama runs, I mean, we would look at Clemson and we look at Ohio State and maybe a Miami team or a Florida State team, and we would say, oh yeah, I could see the USC. They could go do that. LSU could go do that. But now it's kind of like maybe them, long shot them. There's nobody that we just say, I'll put them on the table right now, push my chips to the middle and let's go. I'll ride them all the way to the end. I bet they win it. That's not what it is anymore, unfortunately, or fortunately.
Cole, you mentioned reset button, right? I want to ask you about a guy who kind of hit one in his own way. You recently spoke to former Alabama center Seth McLaughlin, and he talked about why he left Alabama for Ohio State, where he won the Remington Trophy, and the team obviously won the national title. And he said that he got stagnant in his development, right? Like, he didn't blame the Alabama coaching staff. Rather, he reinforced that, you know, he would have received more individual development elsewhere, which is why he left. But, you know, he brought up the Rose Bowl loss to Michigan, how his phone started blowing up when he got to the locker room. He saw that he was catching a lot of the blame for the loss. What do you think of Seth's logic for transferring? Did what he say make sense to you?
Well, this question is a little bit unfair because I know the entire story. And that has come from four or five different angles and four or five different people who I don't really believe that I'm at liberty sharing all of them with, one of them being Seth. And I didn't feel like it was really fair to even ask him about it, to lay it out there, because there are multiple vantage points and not one of them is going to be right. And it's pointless to essentially try and put the blame on one side of it or more blame on one side of it. It happened. It's over. The perception of that's probably not going to change for most people. So I didn't feel like I even wanted to try to put him through it. The development part I thought was very interesting. However, when you listen to him go into it a little bit further in the interview, it did make sense in that he was one of the most experienced guys. There were other pieces of that offensive line that needed help, needed extra coaching, needed assistance. And then if you consider the fact that maybe even the newer pieces that didn't have a spot, let's say they didn't have a spot down on paper, as in, all right, this has got to be our left tackle, guys. Like, he's not ready, but he's going to be our left tackle. Well, then what if that's two guys that you're uncertain of? Like, maybe it's player A, and it's not him, it's going to be player B. Sometimes you know it's player A, Ben, and it's just never going to be great, and you have to circumvent it, and you have to feel it out and understand it and just work with it. Sometimes it might be him, it might be him. And you know what? If this guy comes along in the next 2 weeks, he's got the ability, maybe we'll give him a shot. Well, now you're giving three guys reps. And you're trying to work with those guys to get them all ready. And then if there's two guards over here that have to get ready and they're not necessarily up to speed where they need to be, or a backup center that's never played it before, all of that individual coaching and time and effort goes there. So I can see where that could be a part of someone's, quote, development that they looked at and said, the Bo Nix theory is kind of what I bring up here. Because people always ask me all the time, like, man, like, why couldn't it work at Auburn? Why wasn't it there? Like, we don't ever understand situationally what things are. That includes mentally, emotionally, perceptionally, how you look at a coach, how you think a coach looks at you. And I promise you, that can go a long way in how you receive coaching. If you think your coach is attacking you every day, you're probably not accepting that message of what actually needs to be done to get better. If you're going in defensive, and you're going in thinking this guy just doesn't like me and he's trying to run me out of here, like, you ain't getting better. And you're not going to go out there and do the things necessary that he's asking you to do the way that they need to be done, because you're just pissed off. And that's just, I get defensive. My wife gets on me all the time. She's like, don't get mad. Just do it and figure it out. And it's like, yes, you're right. We need to hear that sometimes. And so there's a lot that can go into that. I don't think it was Nick Saban saying, hey, leave Seth McLaughlin alone. He'll be fine. Work with the other guys. It's not like that. It's just that situationally there's a lot going on. And let's be real. He referenced it. I mean, people giving out his address, people calling him, you know, people DMing him. That kind of shit gets old, man. Like, there comes a point in time when you're like, enough's enough. I got to walk. Like, I can't do this anymore. And it's why I wanted to follow up the question with him just about the phones with today's college football players, because it's wild the amount of times that I see players about to play a game hooked on their phones, like locked into their phones in uniforms. And you're just thinking, man, like, that, I didn't have to deal with that. So I don't even know what that would be like, but that has to be an absolute Royal Rumble for a head coach every day to just sit there and say, how are we going to get the, I can remember talking to Jeremy Pruitt when he was at Alabama, and we were talking about, because we were talking about watching film, and he's like, Cole, these guys ain't like you were. He's like, we went in there, y'all go in there, watch film for 3 hours, and y'all were fine. He's like, these kids go in there now. He goes, I make them watch for 10 minutes, and then we get a 2-minute break. 10 minutes, and we get a 2-minute break. And I'm sitting there going, God, that would have been amazing. Like, you go watch like 2 series or 4 series, and then all of a sudden I get to walk around and come back. Like, we were grinding for hours. And I'm not trying to do the, you know, I walk to school uphill in the snow, you know, back and forth, barefoot, whatever. It's just different. So I can't even reference to how I, well, to a certain extent, I can tell you how it gets to me. Once again, my wife will tell me, she's like, hey, that thing is affecting your personality right now. Put it down. Like when something happened after Ohio State, Tennessee, I knew, Ben, I knew right then when that game was over, I said, not tonight. Just not doing it. I knew what was coming. I knew what was coming. I just said, we're going to leave you over there and we're going to go do something else. And we'll worry about that tomorrow. So I think there's just a lot more that goes into it than thinking a kid had 3 or 4 bad snaps.
Yeah. I mean, I like that he opened up about it. I like that he gave a specific answer and he pulled back the curtain a little bit on like why a player might transfer from a school where it's not just the perception that, oh, they're going to get more money wherever they go, right? Like there's something personal going on. There's something related to their development where they want to reach the next level. They want to improve as a player that's going on. And look, like I don't blame kids for transferring at this point. It just is what it is. You know, and if it is money, go get the best deal that you possibly can while you still can in the NIL era, right? Like while it's the Wild Wild West, as people are referring to it now. But there are cases like his, too, where it's just like, look, like this isn't the best football situation for me. And maybe it's not psychologically the best situation for me in the aftermath of what happened in the Rose Bowl. I noticed that you said Royal Rumble. It happened a few days ago. I doubt that's a coincidence. And then you threw in the Jeremy Pruitt impression, too. I was not expecting that. So thank you for sharing that.
I got some of the best Jeremy Pruitt stories you've ever heard. But
we'll ask for more of that.
I can't say them on this podcast.
Well, we'll see. We'll see what we can get out of you. Well,
there are guys that do this, I'll just say, right. And like he said, he went and talked to Coach Saban. Coach Saban told him he wanted to stay. I brought up the Bo Nix situation. That ended up working out really well for him. And I actually talked to Brian Harsin about that way after the fact. And he goes, you know what? It was a mutual separation and he needed it. He said, I don't even know how much he needed it mentally and emotionally. He said, the pressure was just so great. And that's where I think you saw some of the petulance and some of the attitude begin to look very negative because there was so much on him. And I haven't talked to him about it. I have no idea. But I think the perception was, well, look at this kid. He's acting like a 4-year-old. But then the reality very well could have been he's hearing about it from so many people every day. Like, why are you not winning? Why are you not as good as your dad? Like, why are you not beating Alabama? Like that, once again, that gets old. And you're like, you know what? I'm going to go to as far that way to play college football as I can. So I don't have to deal with this anymore. And he kind of got it turned around, similar to Seth. Like Seth, he didn't need to get anything turned around, but he had a great year while he played before he got injured. I hate that he got injured, but the portal's reputation right now are the guys that are leaving every other year, or the guys that are leaving twice in a year, or the guys that go somewhere and they literally haven't even moved into their apartment. And then you hear that they're going to go somewhere else, or a guy that goes somewhere for the spring semester and he actually plays football at a different school in the fall semester. Like those are the ones we look at and say, all right, this is dumb. What are we doing here? But it can be used in a way that is beneficial for everyone. It's just that we only focus on a lot of, and listen, I think the portal is the biggest problem we have in college football, but it's the abusers, not the ones that are taking advantage of it to better themselves, because maybe wherever they are, they've just hit the end of the road there and they feel like they need to try something different.
And he's a guy who obviously still has love for Alabama. It's no part doubt of his identity still. I mean, what was he doing after Ohio State beat Tennessee on the sideline? Remember, he was smoking a cigar,
yeah,
right? Like, in what hat was he wearing when you talked to him during that interview? It said, run the damn ball, right? Which is a phrase that I'm sure that a lot of people have adopted, but it was very popular at Alabama for a long time. So, you know, I'm glad things worked out for Seth McLaughlin. And, you know, you played the position that he plays, right? Like, in chemistry is obviously something that a center and quarterback must develop. And I wonder from your perspective, a guy who did it, right? Like, how does that normally work? Like, are those positions any closer than others on the team? Like, it's more complicated than I'm sure to say, like, you know, the quarterback says, I say hike, you snap the ball, right? Like, what are the key components to making that dynamic be the best that it can be on game day?
I think most of those relationships are different. I mean, I can speak to mine and tell you that before Ben Leard and I were starters, we wanted to be starters. And so we would, in the summer, every day after we worked out, we'd go out on the practice field and we would snap, 200, 300 balls. inside zone to the right, outside zone to the right, inside zone to the left, outside zone to the left, counter right, counter left, three-step drop, slide protection, seven-step drop, five-step drop, shotgun. Like, we did it all because we wanted to, that we wanted that to never be an afterthought. And so we did it every day. It was repetition. And so we knew, he knew that if we were down on the goal line running quarterback sneak, like, his hands needed to be a little bit further under me. If we were running outside zone, he knew to creep his hands to the right just a little bit if we were going that direction, because that ball was going to shift that way just a little bit. Like, you don't just have – that doesn't happen overnight. So, and then we were also – he was, I mean, I was in his wedding. He was in my wedding. It's – I think that just kind of happened naturally. But there – it's a little bit different in today's day and age with the clap that goes into it. So now it used to just be a verbal cadence – by the quarterback. And then when we would go shotgun, it was my verbal cadence because we would go on ball movement, but I wanted to make it audible also for my other teammates playing on the offensive line. Now there are indicators. Some of those are silent. Some of those are verbal. And then the indicator can be the signal to actually snap the ball on you when you want to. There are actual snap counts still. Obviously, you're going to have hard counts. You got to try to get people to jump offside. So depending on how your offense manages, I mean, obviously, some offenses that go extremely fast have none of these the majority of the time. They just get on the ball and literally snap the ball as fast as they can. So a lot of it depends on your rhythm, your cadence, your timing, your indicators, which are the most important part of this conversation. And that is essentially when you are allowed to or need to snap the football, and those can become confusing. But there can be a lot that goes into it. There can be little that goes into it. I think the more that those two have a relationship, the fewer things you're going to have to actually worry about to make sure that that's consistently something that does not become concerning.
You know, and in Alabama's case with the offensive line, I mean, they bring back three starters in Brailsford, Proctor, and Roberts, yeah. Right? Wilcomb Formby has – he got real reps last year. He played in games, yeah. So he's got experience. But where do you see that unit going in 2025? Is it one of Alabama's strengths, or are there still big question marks for you?
No, I think it can be a strength. I mean, losing Tyler Booker, you're never going to say, oh, that's good, because I think he's the best offensive lineman in college football last year. And he's been that for Alabama for multiple years. So that's going to hurt. But Brailsford was incredible last year. I had very mild concerns about his size, but I watched him play at Washington. We took him the Joe Moore Award. Like, I knew the kid could play. And he put on a little bit of weight. I think playing next to Booker helped him some. Added a little more physicality to what he did, a little more nasty on every play, because he was fighting people on the field last year in a good way. But Proctor's played a lot of football, so you would hope that that left tackle spot can get locked down. He had struggles towards the end of the season. I've seen Cam Dewberry play at A&M. He can be a good football player. He's been a little inconsistent, but he has the makings of being an all-SEC guard. You mentioned Formby played a little bit. If Jaden Roberts is healthy, I mean, he could be almost what Tyler Booker was. Like, the physicality is there, the nasty is there, the finish is there. And, you know, that's just going to come down to mentally having an idea of how to operate and then physically being ready to play. And he could be incredible for them. And I thought Geno Vandermark got good reps for them last year as well. That was one where you saw him play against Vanderbilt. And a lot of people kind of thought that there was maybe something going on. And I talked to Kalen about it, and Kalen just said, listen, he's been practicing so well, we want to get him reps. We want him to play. He deserves it because he's practicing well. So that helped their numbers a little bit. But the right tackle spot, I think, with Formby, if it's not him, you worry about it a little bit. But I think it has a chance to be – the thing that they won't have that they had last year will be the benefit of the tight ends. I mean, those – Robbie Utes and CJ Dupree, man, like, they were having extra, they were like undersized guards on the field. Like, those guys brought it. And it's one of the reasons, going back to why I said, I really wish that they would have tried to live that way a little bit more, because they had the bonus bigs to go do it, not just the offensive line and the backs. So that part might be a little bit different, but I do think that that unit can be good, maybe one of the better in the SEC.
You're one of my favorite follows on Twitter, Cole, because of how you single out offensive line play. You say things like slab, or, like, you know, you focus on just very individual things that nobody else is seeing during game action, right? And I think Robbie Utes was probably singled out on your timeline a couple of times as somebody who just made plays, like, constantly, one rep after the other. And he's going to be a guy that Alabama obviously misses. What about the rest of Alabama, whether it's on the other side of the ball with the defensive line? Like, what position are you looking at where, if they figure that out, then they are dangerous next season? Or if they don't, then they're in serious trouble.
Yeah, I'm going to probably go, honestly, wide receiver opposite Ryan Williams. I think Ryan Williams is amazing. I think he's been, I think he's kind of forgotten about going into this offseason. I would have him as a top five player returning in all of college football. We know he can be special, but you honestly, you can't win with one anymore. I mean, this is not like the Lane Kiffin, Amari Cooper days where you dial it up to him 158 times during a season and people just can't cover him. So you have to have that complement. And I feel like that group was a little bit of a letdown last year. Now, Jeremy Bernard had a great year and he'll be back. And I think he can help a lot, but it's just that position has to have real juice. And I think when it does now, it opens things up for everybody else. And if the offensive line doesn't become great, are they going to be able to run the football the way that they want to? I would maybe say just overall defensive depth also. Like, I thought LT Overton exceeded my expectations last year. James Smith played really good football. He's got heavy hands. He played good on D-line. Tim Keenum's playing a bunch of football. And if Quay Russo is healthy, he showed some signs early last year that he could sort of – he could be that twitchy, like, newer age edge defender that Alabama hasn't had a ton of. But I think he can be that guy. Linebacker depth also scares me. I think Deontay Lawson's amazing. Justin Jefferson can fly. He can run. But you're going to have – I mean, it showed you last year. You got to have more than two or three. You're going to have different guys that can play. It's just such a – it's such a rugged position. You're asked to run a lot more. You're asked to cover. You're asked to still be physical. You're going to probably be on some special teams. You need numbers at that spot. So, but I love the veteran presence at certain places. Like, you have the ultimate leader in Deontay Lawson at linebacker. You have the ultimate leader in Parker Brailsford at center. You're going to have Keon Sabb back at safety. A guy's been around a lot of college football for a long time. So, like, those are key positions that you need leadership at. I know quarterback's the one everybody will look at, so you got to have that. But let's say it ends up being Ty Simpson, somebody who's a lifer in that program, who's been around all those players, who knows the ins, the outs. All of a sudden there, you probably get a little bit more leadership than you do from a first-year starting quarterback the majority of the time. So that could end up being a beneficial part of him winning that job. So I think that there's a lot to like about it. It's just, how many guys do they have that truly scare you beyond belief, like Nick Saban used to have? And that's the difference. And there are not a lot of teams in college football that have a lot of those guys anymore. Ohio State had a bunch this year. We thought Texas had a bunch this year. Georgia had a few. But Nick Saban used to have like 8, 9, or 10 of those guys. You couldn't do anything about them. And they're now dispersed a little bit more across college football. So I think the foundation of what Kalen DeBoer has is solid. You're just going to have to find a few guys. And also with Grubb coming in and the quarterback change, we know this, it won't be as run heavy from that position. So it's going to be different. And does that take some more adaptation? I don't think it does. Look at what Mike Penix did. And they carried run plays for him at Washington. So look what Jake Haener did at Fresno State. So it could be a benefit to this team in this offense if it's somebody that can manage that part of the offense in a little bit of more of efficient way.
Well, we're a ways away from seeing it all, you know, come together and seeing these guys back on the field and what year two looks like. But we're in the middle of basketball season, Cole. And as you know, we are only days away from the most anticipated, to use a phrase that you love, Iron Bowl of basketball of our lifetimes, maybe ever in the history of these programs. And, you know, I wonder, as a guy who is part of Auburn's football history and tradition and in a rivalry where football always overshadowed basketball, what's it like to see these two programs having this type of success at the same time?
Well, I don't know what the other thing you referenced is. I've never heard of that, and that's not a real thing. The Iron Bowl is a football game. But I love watching Bruce Pearl's teams, plural. I love watching this team, especially considering that they do it with a little bit bigger bodies and a little more physicality. I got a text from a couple Oklahoma fans last night, just be like, man, that was a bloodbath. And it kind of, I reflected on this team a little bit, and I feel like they have just the right mix of, like, don't give a rip and know exactly how to handle things. And it's pretty apparent with how things happened later in that game last night. They're going to have to manage some of that down the road. But they've got the perimeter game that they didn't have last year. They've got the inside game that they haven't had some other years. And I think most of all, they just got grown-ups. I mean, Dylan Cardwell, Jani Broome, those guys have been around for a long time. Like, they just understand all of it. And then you have – I mean, just a dynamo who's coming off the bench at, I guess, point guard that in Pettaway, who's just unbelievable in so many different ways. So, and they have role players. Bruce does such a good job of just managing the expectation of the team and what's going to happen, what should happen, why it happens. But man, this having these two teams in the top five for the majority of this season has been wild. It's just, we've seen great Bama runs. We've seen some good Auburn runs. We haven't seen like this, what we've seen the last couple years, consistently go. And it makes it more fun. It makes the rivalry better. It makes living in Birmingham better, doing sports radio in Birmingham better. I have a ton of respect for Nate Oates. I've had a ton of great conversations with him. Do I want him to be good? No. I mean, I'll just be honest. It has nothing to do with Nate Oates. But, I mean, I want Auburn to win that game. So, that's just kind of the reality of it. But it is cool to see them both doing as well as they are.
Well, yeah.
Like, I mean, we get tired of just handing that thing like Duke and Carolina and Kansas. Like, enough already. Like, it's – we want a little bit of that. And it feels like we got it.
Auburn. Duke did beat Auburn, though, right? That's their only loss this year, right? So, Duke's still in it. Auburn knows.
Oh, no, in it. But I'm just saying, like, as far as national coverage and only good teams, like – you know, I grew up Michigan, UCLA, Kentucky. It's like enough already. Like, we're ready for some new blood here. And it's pretty cool that it's Auburn and Alabama that are taking some of it.
And it's probably, look, I mean, it's possible that game's 1-2, right? Like, if both of these teams handle their business before February 15th, and then you've got what has to be the biggest game in this state's history in college basketball. So that's going to be really exciting. Okay, Cole, we're going to get you out of here on this. You said you didn't watch hardly any NFL during the season because of all the other film you're having to watch, the analysis you're having to do. Super Bowl's on Sunday. If you have a pick, you're willing to share. Who's it going to be?
Oh, yeah. I had a fun conversation. A couple of the dads roped me and my son into fantasy football this year. I had tried it one other year, despised it. I do not want to raise a fantasy football fan, but I kind of thought maybe it's a way for me and my 7-year-old to, you know, enjoy football together just a little bit more. It ended up being pretty cool. We didn't spend a ton of time on it, but it got him more familiar with more players. And so through the playoffs, we've been kind of picking games and talking about games. And last weekend, we picked the championship games. And, you know, he was it is really odd how last year at school pickup, it was Pat Mahomes jerseys everywhere. This year at school pickup, it's like Josh Allen jerseys everywhere. Like, he is, like, all of a sudden the kid favorite now. And so I have a brother-in-law, Nico Giovino, who is a massive Bills fan, grew up in Buffalo. And so I think he kind of wore off them at Christmas a little bit too. And they were super – him and my 4-year-old were super confident Buffalo was going to win that game. And right before the game, they kind of turned to me and I said, listen, kids, you don't bet against Patrick Mahomes, okay? And I had such a proud dad moment. Actually, on the way to school today, we were talking about Super Bowl this weekend. I said, y'all got picks yet? And my 7-year-old leaned over and he said, Dad, don't pick against Patrick Mahomes. And I was like, there you go. I ain't betting against Mahomes. So, yeah, I'll take the Chiefs.
I buy that logic. You know, look, I'm kind of hoping Philadelphia wins. Better story. We're obviously big Jalen Hurts fans around here. Devontae Smith, Landon Dickerson. I'm sure you're a fan of that guy. But, yeah, I'm with you. I mean, like, head says you never bet against that guy. And
I mean, I think Philadelphia has the better roster. I think overall, when you look at Saquon, what he's added, obviously A.J. Brown, you mentioned Devonta. I mean, it's just like they have the better roster, but it's just – it's Patrick Mahomes, man. Like,
yeah, they can win. They can win.
Oh, yeah.
Will they win? I don't know. Well, look, I mean, Cole, like, you've been so generous with your time. You can find Cole Kubelik on the SEC Network. Listen to McElroy and Kubelik in the morning, weekday morning, 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. on WJOX. Cole, we're big fans of yours. Thank you so much for doing this, man.
I appreciate you guys having me.